one of the letters to Mr. Sinnott, published, of course, in the Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnott, a letter which deals really principally with Devachan and questions that were put to the Mahatma by Mr. Sinnott on that very abstruse subject. In the midst of it, the Master K.H. advised Mr. Sinnott, "You can do nothing better than to study the two doctrines of karma and nirvana as profoundly as you can. Unless you are thoroughly well acquainted with the two tenets, the double key to the metaphysics of Abhidharma, you will always find yourself at sea in trying to comprehend the rest. We have several sorts of karma and nirvana in their various applications." A very interesting statement, a statement that I think deserves deep consideration and much thought and certainly much study. Although there may be a tendency to dismiss it as abstruse Buddhist metaphysics without a great deal of relevance to the more basic theosophical principles to which we've become accustomed, and the principles which, as indicated by the theme of this summer school, may be guidelines or may be helpful in guiding us in a theosophic life. Karma, yes, of course, we're all familiar with it, an essential concept inherent in the theosophical worldview, necessary as a guide in our lives, and we're accustomed to thinking of it in sort of packaged bits that fall down from the ceiling occasionally and hit us on the head, and we have to pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and hope we escape any further bricks, karmic bricks, that fall upon us. Nirvana, well, really, what relevance does that have? But I am going to dare to suggest, having the privilege that speakers have of at least being able to suggest, and I have a podium here that I can always hide behind if anyone feels like throwing things the moment I suggest it, but I do suggest that the concept of nirvana is related to, if not identical with, that less familiar principle which is known as dharma. There, of course, may be considerable skepticism about this and about the placement of these two ideas in a central position within the theosophical framework, but I so dare to do. The prerogative of having served the society for as long as I have and having attained a certain age gives me the right to make any suggestion I damn well please. Well, precisely then, because the human state is central to the entire metaphysic of theosophy, for that metaphysic, I suggest, is rooted in the proposition that reality is realizable, and its realizability is possible only through consciousness, or more precisely, self-consciousness. It is therefore in reference to the human condition, that human state in which we all, I presume, are today sharing, that we must seek the fundamentals of the theosophical worldview in terms of principles which can guide us in our living, and in our living today particularly. Now, such a proposition, of course, indicates, I think, the coherence, the inner integrity, and the holistic nature of that worldview. But this does not exclude paradox. Indeed, there is paradox. There is mystery forever leading us onward in our quest for the realizability of the universal, of the ultimate. Well, to make a beginning then, let us recognize that we, along with all sentient beings, all existent beings, are engaged in a journey, in a great adventure. Now, whether we perceive that journey as simply a kind of progression, a pilgrimage which takes place from our birthing to our dying, or on some grander scale through all the cycles of aeonic existence that include the numerous incarnations from our unconscious beginnings to our conscious, self-conscious perfectings, the pattern of the adventure remains the same. However we consider it, if you just consider the journey from the time you arose this morning to whatever time you decide to go to sleep tonight, however you consider it, there appears to be a journey. There appears to be a passage. We have moved in some manner. And I suggest that there are patterns in this adventure, and it's that pattern, that ordering, which we may discover, and which I think constitutes the most exciting, if not the most challenging, concept inherent in the theosophical worldview. For the pattern really is one of beauty. It's of the perfect proportion of all things, if we can begin to observe the proportion that is there. The essential rightness of creation itself, the rightness of every single moment. We participate in that. We are held by that. We move in accordance with that divinely appointed, if I may call it that, that ordering which is inherent in life itself. And ultimately, we are therefore one with that. The very truth of our being, the supreme order, whose heart is bliss and peace. Well, what then is this heroic journey of my title? It is simply that journey because you are the hero. You're the hero of your own story, even if no one else's. You may be a hero in no one else's eyes, but you are the hero of the journey that you are taking, of the novel you are writing, of the whole fable and allegory that you are living out. And so the heroic journey is simply, I suggest, to live each day, each hour, each moment in full and conscious awareness of that underlying order, that cosmic harmony in which we are rooted, grounded, established. I think it is to live in accordance with the law, if I may call it that, of one's own best being. To live, in other words, always beyond ourselves. And to act in such a manner that every action mirrors in its spontaneous rightness the cosmic act of creation itself. The heroic journey, the great adventure on which we're embarked then, is the journey of the soul through our humanhood to the realm of the gods. It is the journey from the bondage of non-knowing to the nirvanic freedom of luminous wisdom. It is the adventure of the spirit involving both the descent into hell and the ascent into heaven. Stages symbolized, of course, in all of the great mystery schools and re-experienced in our lives as the painful and the happy moments produced by our own thoughts, feelings, and actions. And the twin keys, then, I suggest to this heroic journey, the twin guidelines, the twin principles that may assist us as we become aware of the nature of the journey in which we're involved, this journey of the hero, which is each one of us, are those great ideas to which many names have been given in many different traditions, and which are very frequently spoken of course, in our own literature as karma and dharma. karma as that one eternal law in nature, as H.P. Blavatsky defined it. That law which, she said, always tends to adjust contraries and to produce final harmony. And dharma, from which I suggest karma cannot be separated conceptually, and which has been translated in so many different ways, righteousness, duty, that which upholds, sustains, nourishes our being, that is indeed the essence of our being, the characteristic of our being. These two, interestingly enough, are but aspects of one cosmic principle which was known in the Vedas as Rita, R-T-A, but the R is the Sanskrit vowel, R, Rita. It's very interesting that in the oldest scriptures of the world, the Vedas, karma and dharma are not mentioned except as implied as principles or aspects of this fundamental cosmic principle. The journey, in other words, may be more simply expressed, the way we all must take from non-knowing to knowing, from non-seeing to seeing, which is simply to say from avidya, which is non-seeing, to vidya, seeing, from non-hearing to hearing, the journey from karma to nirvana. Saint Paul, in his letter to the Galatians, spoke of this very same way. It is not, therefore, absent from the Christian tradition. For St. Paul wrote to the Galatians, "Stand fast in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. For, brethren, ye have been called unto liberty. Walk in the Spirit. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law." A wonderful statement and words full of quite mystical meaning, I suggest, when read in the light of the concepts that we're now considering this evening. For to stand fast in liberty is simply to be established in that which one is, that is, in one's dharma, to be established and identified with that Christ principle which animates us, and therefore no longer to be subject to that bondage, of the yoke of bondage of which St. Paul spoke, which is simply that outer law, or that law which appears to be outer, and therefore has buffeted us about for so very long because we have been simply ignorant of its nature. To walk the world in that knowledge is to know what St. Paul called the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, goodness. To realize, in other words, nirvana in the sense of the extinction of a personal self, for one simply has set aside any thought of the self because it's irrelevant, if one may put it there. It simply does not exist. The bliss, then, of the one self, here and now. It is to know, therefore, as the great Buddhist sage Nagarjuna put it, nirvana is samsara, samsara is nirvana. Between the two, there is no distinction. Well, to come to that knowing, which is wisdom, to answer what St. Paul so beautifully termed the call to liberty, which is enlightenment, spiritual illumination, means simply, I suggest, in the theosophical context, to enter upon the way or path that leads to the realization of the essential unity of all life. The Rig Veda seer asked long ago, "Who can here declare the pathway that leads on to the gods?" Well, it's that pathway that we all must take, either in full awareness of the task before us, or unconsciously driven onwards by the inexorable laws that govern all manifested existence. A Hebrew proverb has it that man was created for the sake of choice. And choice in the way of our going is surely the most priceless of our human rights, of all human rights. And that choice, even when it is the wrong choice, is still a priceless right. For I've often thought the greatest right we have is the right to be wrong. And so even when that wrongness appears to lie only in the continued experience of disequilibrium, the sense of conflict and suffering which we all too often attribute to karma, we're only aware of it, as it were, you know, as we're perhaps only aware of, really aware of gravity when we step off a window ledge, and then we know all too well the law of gravity. We are unaware of it, although it is acting all the time. We are exhibiting it. It is a field in which we ourselves are test objects, of course. And we fail to see that karma is simply the, if I may put it this way, merely the lawfulness of existence itself, productive, therefore, only of that which is in harmony with the causes that we ourselves have set in motion. H.P. Blavatsky pointed out that karma is a word of many meanings, reminding us of the master's statement that there are many kinds of karma and nirvana. And further commenting, she has said, "It is owing to this law of spiritual development, superseding the physical and purely intellectual, that mankind will become freed from its false gods and find itself finally self-redeemed." In the Theosophical Glossary, she further defined it as ethical causation, adding that karma neither punishes nor rewards. It is simply the one universal law which guides unerringly, and so to say blindly, all other laws productive of certain effects along the grooves of their respective causations. And she adds further that when Buddhism teaches that karma is that moral kernel of any being which alone survives death and continues throughout all reincarnations, it simply means that there remains naught after each personality but the causes produced by it, causes which are undying, that is, which cannot be eliminated from the universe until replaced by their legitimate effects and wiped out by them. But karma is but one half the key, then, that unlocks the meaning of existence and that can help us, guide us in our ordinary everyday lives as we travel the pathway that leads onward to the gods. It's not enough, in other words, simply to eliminate the causes we ourselves have set in motion and from which we all too often seek escape simply by generating further causes which have still worse effects. Within the context of achieving the aim of the human quest, we have an obligation, I suggest, an obligation to undertake our dharmic responsibility to travel the pathway that leads onward to the redemption of ourselves and the redemption of the world. For that is our destiny, to be world redeemers as the self-redeemed of the world. And so dharma, I suggest, is the other half of the key that unlocks the meaning and purpose of existence. The contemporary Indian philosopher Radhakrishnan, one time vice president of India, suggested that next to the category of reality, the most important concept in Indian thought is that of dharma. And this is so, he added, not as a matter of chance, but as the necessary consequence of the basic postulate of an ultimate reality, which is both immanent and transcendent. Ultimately and ideally, Radhakrishnan suggested, there is, as indeed the theosophical worldview postulates, no duality between Brahman and the universe, one the mirror image of the other. And consequently, our duty, as Radhakrishnan put it, is to return from the plurality into the one through our experiences in and with the plurality. The law of morality, or dharma, is an invitation to perform just this task, the work of becoming perfect, as the Christian scripture enjoins, the task which the alchemists called the opus contra naturam, that is, the work which is against the downward and outward multiplicity of the flow of nature into diversity, the one becoming multiple. Dharma, then, is simply the law of our best being, inspired by the one reality pervading and penetrating the entire universe, and to act according to which is desirable, fundamentally moral, and conducive to the fulfillment of our human state, to become truly human. Hence, to dharma, from the Sanskrit root dhri, which means to hold together, to sustain, to nourish, a multiplicity of meanings, even in the root verb dhri in the Sanskrit, also means the characteristic nature, that which is the essence of each particular. And the dharma of an individual is consequently the essential quality of a human being in terms of his or her moral obligations, since to be human is to be an ethical and moral being, an entity with ethical obligations. Krishna very much emphasized this fact to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, when he enjoined him in no uncertain terms that he had to act, because to be human is to act, and even though every action carries with it its own burden of consequences, one has to act, for even not to act is to act. As Krishna wisely told Arjuna in the final chapter of the Gita, chapter 18, all undertakings are clouded by defects as fire by smoke. So everything one does is clouded, as it were, but it is of the very nature of being human to act. There is always karma. And yet, as also in the final chapter, Arjuna is instructed by Krishna, better is one's own duty, though destitute of merits, than the well-executed duty of another. He who doeth the duty laid down by his own nature incurreth not sin. Well, here is truly, then, I suggest, the royal secret communicated by Krishna to Arjuna, as it has been communicated by every teacher from time immemorial to his disciple. We had it, as already noted, in the words of St. Paul, walk in the Spirit. Against such there is no law. That is, there is no consequence that accrues to the individual. A very beautiful concept. So how are we to achieve that condition in which karma and dharma are unified? In the yogic literature, the path is described given as by means of tapas, which is simply the burning away or eliminating all that is non-essential. In Buddhism, the aspirant is enjoined to engage in upaya, skillful means, action that reflects both wisdom, prajna, and compassion, karuna. In the Gnostic, the tradition of the Gnostic writers and sages, the principle of self-discipline, the regulation of one's action in accordance with one's dharma, was known as askesis, or spiritual skill, a term, incidentally, from which we derive our much misunderstood English word, asceticism, and have certainly come very far from its original meaning in the Greek of ascesis as spiritual skill, which was simply the attunement, the alignment of one's nature with that which one essentially is. Well, to understand fully this concept of Dharma is as difficult, really, as to understand fully the concept of karma. Although we feel we already know everything there is to be known about karma, and in one sense, I suppose, we've been up against it for so many lives, we ought to begin to know quite a bit about it. But, as the Mahatma K.H. pointed out to Mr. Sinnott, we have several sorts of karma and nirvana in their various applications. And I am suggesting, as I've already mentioned, that in one sense, nirvana in that context, that is, the snuffing out, the burning away, tapas, the burning away, the ascesis in which the personal egoistic self is simply consumed, or snuffed out, is nearly synonymous to, or at least correlate with, the concept of Dharma as the fulfillment of one's essential nature, a fulfillment in which the personal, egoistic desire self is altogether dissolved. Dharma has been defined in quite a number of ways in the various Sanskrit works, from the Vedas to the Dharmashastra literature. And as already noted, in terms of the individual, it is said to refer to our moral obligations. We dislike this term obligation, I know, but it refers to the very fact that by the nature of being human, by having, as it were, come this far and achieved, and as the Buddhist would say, having achieved a human incarnation, which is a rich privilege. Shankaracharya makes this clear also in the Viveka Chudanami. The very privilege of having a human incarnation imposes upon us, as it were, certain obligations, which are moral obligations. In terms of society as a whole, then, Dharma has been defined as social solidarity. In the context of religion, Dharma has been called beatitude, since that is said to be the characteristic essential nature of religion itself, pure religion. While in the context of law, Dharma represents its essential property as justice. In every category, therefore, it represents what we may call the imperative necessity of the mundane order to reflect the cosmic order, while at the same time it also represents the potential for further growth and transformation, since the dynamism of the process is the characteristic feature of the cosmos itself. Well, I suggest that nowhere are these two concepts, karma and dharma, or two aspects rather, of one fundamental premise, more beautifully described as characteristics of the ultimate reality, the One, than in those glorious hymns of ancient India, the Vedas, and of course most particularly in that original first Rig Veda. A full examination of the Vedic concept is not my purpose this evening. It would take us very far afield, even if I were capable of giving it to you. But even a cursory view of it may be useful in seeing that we are only dealing with one principle. And this really underlies everything in our lives. It's the fundamental structure of the cosmos itself in which we, as human beings, are active participants. As Renee referred this afternoon to Dr. Wheeler, we live in a participatory universe. So to understand this significance, the significance of the concept of cosmic order, spoken of in the Vedas, the Rig Veda as Rita, we must, I think, see very briefly the manner of cosmic origins as expounded in the Rig Veda. The rishis, of course, responsible for the great Vedic hymns, and of course hymns they are indeed, thought of the entire origin of the universe, or it was revealed to them in divine, in tremendous meditation, as a projection into manifestation through a process which can only be defined as divine contemplation. And they, in their contemplations, mirrored this process and therefore, through the hymns, give this particular view, this world view. A manifestation, a projection, a process by which all that lies latent within the One, the eternal That, an unfoldment from within without, as the secret doctrine so aptly describes it, and an emanational process, therefore, that moves through three definite stages, or implying, therefore, three levels of the world order. The first was maybe termed the primordial or transcendental level, the original emergence from the One, manifesting Ritta or cosmic order as the blueprint for all successive emanations. Fundamental, therefore, is cosmic order. It is the emergence, therefore, of those intelligences which will represent, and not to be anthropomorphized, which represent in their very being that cosmic order. Janine Miller, in her excellent work on the Vedas, defines the gods, therefore, as the personified agents of Ritta or cosmic order or harmony, whose ordinances shine through that eternal foundation of all that exists. This Ritta, therefore, implies that perfect harmony existing between the essence of being, Sat, if you like the Sanskrit, and its activity between the inner and the outer, the latter being but the effect and in some sense the mirror of the former. Now this pattern or blueprint thus established, the scene is prepared, as it were, for that cosmic action which is in accordance with the inherent lawfulness of the entire process. What Dr. Marie-Louise von Franz, one of Dr. Jung's students, always calls the just so-ness of things. It is just so. And, what else can you say, as it were? As Janine Miller further points out, it implies also, therefore, the spontaneous rightness observable in the majestic movement of the stars, the recurrence of the seasons, the unswerving alternness of day and night, the unerring rhythm of birth, growth, death, of each form of life, that rhythm which is the very breath of the divine action. A statement that may well remind many of you of the second fundamental proposition of the secret doctrine. So at the primordial level, Ritta, or cosmic harmony, expresses itself as the differentiating principle whereby the One becomes the two, and the two become the three, and the three become the many. An ordering principle. The constant transformation involved points to a law of becoming, of change and adjustment, to which all creation and all successive emanations will be subject, all being subservient to this one fundamental law of harmony or transformation, that law which reveals the ordered course of the universal pattern. As the Rig Veda puts it, by law, the herds of the universe, that is, the stars, have entered the cosmic orbit. Firmly fixed are the foundations of Ritta, shining in beauty. Manifold are its beauteous forms. In the natural process of emanation, then, the first level gives rise to the second, the intermediate level, where the gods themselves manifest and function. Here, the universal law, Ritta, provides the dynamics for the unfolding of every realm, or if you prefer, every field in which and through which the One will manifest itself in its multiple forms, the manifestation of all existent things, each god or deva performing his task in perfect harmony with all others. The Rig Veda puts it, and I think so beautifully, one-minded, one-intentioned, unerringly move together to the one purposeful accomplishment. That is brotherhood supreme, is it not? At that level, a brotherhood in which there is one-mindedness, in which the law is perfectly expressed, such is the beautiful description of the action of the intelligent forces in the universe, their solidarity, their essential righteousness, their concerted activity are the unique features of their activity, marking them as agents of the law of harmony, by which, through which, and in which they live and perform their various tasks. Again, if I may just quote some further lines from the Rig Veda, one is the mighty godhood of the Shining Ones, denizens of heaven, flame-tongued, thriving through the law, they abide brooding in the womb of law. True observers of the law, faithful to the law, righteous leaders, bounteous to every man, law-abiding, born in law, sublime fosterers of law, herdsmen of the supreme law, whose decrees are truth. Could there be any more beautiful description of those intelligent agents not to be anthropomorphized at their loftiest levels, and yet, in accordance, and I have to skip over this very quickly, but in accordance, at least in view of the secret doctrine concept, to be seen as products of former systems who have won their immortality through past aeonic cycles. They reveal the cosmic order, embodying it in their very being, since they are established in that nirvanic state in which their nature is both compassion and truth, bliss and knowledge. And I make that statement referring to the secret doctrine because HPB there makes the statement very clearly that every being in the universe either was, is, or will be man, that is to say, will win his immortality. And then finally, as a natural emanation through the cosmic action of these intelligent forces, for the universe is through and through intelligent, there arises the phenomenal world where man rules and by virtue of his freedom disrupts the divine equilibrium, shatters the original cosmic harmony underlying all things, suffering the consequences which we then call karma, in his progress along the pathway of return, that pathway which leads onward to the gods, to enlightenment and illumination. Shattering it because only thus can we come to full self-consciousness. Only thus can we come to the knowing which is vidya, which is Sophia, wisdom. So what is known then as cosmic order exhibits itself in the transcendental and intermediate realms as dharma, the law of becoming in accordance with the rightness of one's being, the inner obedience to that duty which marks one's place in the cosmic scheme. There, in those inner realms, a certain state obtains which has been called on occasion karmalessness, simply because it is no longer producing effects that redound to an individual separate entity. A state of nirvana, therefore, in which there is the extinction of all sense of separateness, of a personal self, in that one-minded, one-intentioned, harmonious action which accords with universal truth. And yet, because of this cosmic order, there is that aspect of the law which we experience in this phenomenal universe, the playground of the human, that aspect which we call karma, failing to recognize that the term itself simply means action. Kri, the Sanskrit word root kri, simply to act. Although all too often, since our actions disrupt the harmony of the universal order, we attribute to it, therefore to karma, values of goodness and badness, which is only our attribution and not present within the principle itself. As the Pseudo-Dionysius put it, we not only have to learn the truth, we have to suffer it. That is to say, we have to bear it. We have to exhibit it. We have to make it somehow manifest. Now, while we've grossly oversimplified the great Vedic tradition, and I have done it a gross injustice in oversimplifying it thus, and therefore have necessarily omitted many equally important aspects of the entire process that we know as the emanation of a manifested universe, that process which, of course, is itself the whole subject of Volume 1 of The Secret Doctrine, I suggest that we begin to see, even out of this very brief survey, the magnificence and the splendor of the theosophic vision in terms of its relevance for us who are embarked knowingly on the human phase of the journey that leads onwards to, well, what shall we call that unknown goal toward which all creation moves? How can we define a culmination still unknown to us? The quest of the Holy Grail, do you wish to call it that? Which we dimly sense, and in our profounder moments of insight, know in some mysterious manner, is both in the distant there and in the very present here of our existence now. To live in accord with that cosmic order, to travel onward in harmony with the law of our inmost being, these are the consequences of Rita in terms of karma and dharma, twin keys then to the heroic journey of our humanhood. These are, if I may use such a word, the demands self-imposed, inherent in the phenomenal world because of the very nature of the transcendent realm of which the phenomenal is an emanation. And I call them demands because one finds in the third fundamental proposition of the sacred doctrine this obligatory pilgrimage. Well, as we turn then to our journey in the realm of the phenomenal, where we are still struggling, trying hard to form a nucleus of universal brotherhood, certainly far from being one-minded, at least theosophists will never be one-minded, one-intentioned, yes, we may be one-intentioned, good intentions, of course, but where we are still struggling in the worlds of manifestation, we may, I think, gain a new appreciation for the concepts of karma and dharma, perceiving in them both challenge and opportunity to move more quickly on our heroic way. For a certain heroism is called for, I think, a bravery of the spirit to accept the challenge of the pathway that leads onward, a soul courage to take up the opportunity, which is our human birthright, the opportunity to win our immortality and join the gods, if I may put it thus, in their aeonic labors. It is truly a great adventure, and I told you I'd return to that word. That very word adventure is so rich in meanings that we've forgotten or overlooked in the narrowings of definitions and the debasement of the beauty of our language. But it's a word that appears very frequently in the legends that arose in Europe in the 12th and 13th centuries. Centuries, incidentally, where one can see many comparisons with our contemporary life at the close of the 20th century. If you study history at all, which is one of my sidelines of great interest, and one can find many things going on at that particular period, the 12th and 13th century, which are very similar, very much to be correlated with what is happening today. Legends, of course, telling of the quest for the Holy Grail. Some scholars translating these legends from the medieval French, which were, of course, the first telling of it appeared in medieval France in about 1190, the end of the 12th century. But some of the scholars have pointed out that the French word aventure from the Old French, aventura from the Middle High German, both, of course, coming from the Latin ad ventura, translated into modern English as adventure, raises problems, really, both linguistic and interpretative, simply because the word itself originally contained, like dharma and karma, such a wealth of meaning that we have no single word in the English language today to define it precisely. In essence, it did mean, if you read carefully, it did mean both karma and dharma, and referred not only to that cosmic order, orita, but to the very emanational progressive unfoldment from within of all that one was or is. In essence, therefore, it referred to both karma and dharma. And when in the Grail legends and the Grail stories, Percival or Parzival in the German was told, go where adventure leads you, it is clear that the direction was intended not to just go out and see what happens to you, you know, as it were, but it was intended as a command to the hero to act in accordance with the pattern established by his own past, what we might today call karma, and also to fulfill his particular mission or destiny, what we might call dharma. I don't have time to illustrate this, but there are many, many parts of the story of Percival in the Chrétien version, Parzival in the Wolfram version, many aspects that point this out very clearly. One, for example, is when Lancelot performs a certain action and is told by the wise man, represented by the hermit, that he has performed the right action. Gawain comes along and immediately fumbles the whole thing, attempting to redo what Lancelot did. And Gawain is told he's only made a fool of himself because it wasn't his place to do it. Better one's own duty, though devoid of merit, in other words. A very interesting concept which one finds. For example, one scholar, Dr. Pauline Matarazzo, points out in her commentary on The Quest of the Holy Grail, that anonymous work attributed to the Cistercian monks, the adventure, she says, is the challenge which causes a man to measure himself against standards more than human. The adventure is above all God working and manifesting himself in the physical world. To accept an adventure is to accept an encounter with a force which is in the proper sense of the word supernatural, an encounter which is always perilous for the man of little faith and much presumption. Marvelous statement. And she adds further, I think it is true, she says, to say that the author of the quest uses the concept of the adventure as a symbol of providence just as precisely and consistently as he uses the Holy Grail as a symbol of mystical experience. So, many words have been used in the translations for this one word which we have as adventure. One can illustrate the idea by numerous references to the Grail legends that appeared in Europe during that very turbulent period of early Middle Ages. Dr. Joseph Campbell, the eminent mythologist, scholar of mythology, comparative mythology, comments at some length on the use of this term adventure in the Grail legends, both in reference to the new values that were coming to birth at that time in Europe and to the changing perspectives of our contemporary world. In his work, for example, on creative mythology, the fourth volume in Dr. Campbell's wonderful series, The Masks of God, he points out in his discussion of this term, adventure, that it had reference to the very fact that the casual, chance, fragmentary events of an apparently undistinguished life disclose the form and dimension of a classic epic of destiny when the cosmic mirror is applied. And our own scattered lives today as well are then seen also as anamorphoses. Very interesting, because we do sometimes think that these events are meaningless. They're casual, fragmentary events. Can we apply a cosmic mirror and we begin to see the form and dimension of a classical epic? The use of that term, by the way, anamorphosis, is most interesting, since it is, of course, from the Greek. You can see my love of words. Dr. John Elgio isn't here this summer to vie with me for giving you definitions. But anamorphosis, from the Greek to form again or anew, refers to a distorted image very often, taking us back to the Vedic concept of this phenomenal realm as an image too often distorted by our perception, but an image of the transcendental sphere of the gods. Time, of course, does not again permit an examination of Dr. Campbell's discussion, which I feel is very perceptive on the terms adventure, fate, kismet, as found in the Islamic tradition, which conveys a more passive acceptance of outside determinants that shape one's life, and the Anglo-Saxon term, a very interesting term, W-Y-R-D, weird, which of course has come down in contemporary English as weird, which means not at all what it did in the Anglo-Saxon world, which conveyed the idea of an inward potentiality in the process of becoming with, however, an approaching inevitable end. And so, of course, if you appear weird to others, it's only that you may be unfolding that inward potentiality which looks very, very strange because it's never been exhibited before. Well, it's an interesting study in itself and, of course, is very much related to a deeper study of karma as a central concept in understanding human destiny. But what I've sought to emphasize in all these remarks tonight is that following the advice of the Master K.H. as to the importance of a study of these two concepts, karma and nirvana, we may derive from such an investigation concepts inherent in the theosophical worldview as it relates to the heroic journey, we may derive a new understanding of the manner in which these principles may serve to guide us today. We may come to recognize that in meeting all that is appropriate to us as a result of all we have been, all that the kernel that has grown up, as it were, of moral and ethical causation, which gives us our present, which we call our karma, and in accepting the challenge of our inevitable destiny to become that which you eternally are, the rightness of our self-becoming nature, we will have declared, made clear, the pathway which leads onwards to the gods. This is the nirvanic pathway, if you like. It is essentially the way of bliss in which the separated self is extinguished in favor of that greater light of the universal self. So from the Vedic seers and rishis, to St. Paul, onwards to the Gnostics, the alchemists, and those who penned the Grail legends, the story has been told of the human, the heroic journey. And we are writing the story of that journey today. The patterns of events in our lives, when we have eyes to see the patterning, reveal, as Dr. Campbell put it, that beneath the surface effects of the world sit, as of yore, the gods. For we here may learn to mirror that cosmic harmony which holds the stars in their orbits and reveals itself in the rhythms of tides and seasons. In the Voice of the Silence, reference is made to a stage when once thy foot hath pressed the bed of the nirvanic stream, a question is asked of the aspirant. What seest thou before thine eyes, O aspirant to godlike wisdom? And the traveler replies, I see the path, its foot in mire, its summits lost in glorious light nirvanic. And now I see the ever-narrowing portals on the hard and thorny road to jnana. Hard and thorny it may at times appear to us to be, the road to knowing jnana, to wisdom sophia. But we are theos, gods in the becoming, theosophists who are willing to tread that way. For to be a theosophist, I suggest, is to tread that way, our destiny no other than to walk onwards. For, as the Voice of the Silence reminds us, the way to final freedom is within thyself.